Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Jane Clayson, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. 3 years ago, Eleanor Clift was caring for her husband, journalist Tom Brazidis, as he entered the final stages of cancer. At that very moment, the nation's attention was captivated by another very public death, Terry Schiavo's. Brazidis died one day before Schiavo. For Clift, these two deaths raised a profound question. What should we do when a loved one's fate is up to us? This hour On Point, Eleanor Clift and her new book, 2 Weeks of Life, a memoir of love, death, and politics. Joining me this hour from Washington, D.C. is Eleanor Clift. Eleanor is a contributing writer for Newsweek magazine. She writes a weekly column called Capital Letter for Newsweek.com. She's also a regular panelist for the PBS public affairs program, The McLaughlin Group. Her new book is called 2 Weeks of Life, a memoir of love, death, and politics. It's a compelling mix of journalism and personal reflection about the very private death of her husband, journalist Tom Brazidis, who had terminal kidney cancer, and the very public death of Terry Schiavo. Schiavo, as you might remember, collapsed from a heart attack when she was only 26. And at the age of 41, her life ended when doctors, acting on a state court order, removed her feeding tube. Tom and Terry died within one day of each other. Eleanor, thank you so much for being with us, and thank you for a really wonderful book.
I'm glad to be with you, Jane.
So much to talk about with you. I want you to read excerpts from your book, hear this very compelling story. But first, I wondered if you'd introduce us to this man, your husband, Tom Brazidis. Tell us about him.
Well, Tom was a journalist and a columnist for the Cleveland Plain Dealer, and he wrote about his illness in a series of columns, a dozen over a period of 6 years. And those columns are all printed in their entirety in the book. The first one was titled Minus One Kidney But Still Flossing. And when he was diagnosed with metastatic cancer, he compared it to being on the 90th floor of the World Trade Tower and not knowing whether he would get out alive, but he was going to try. He drew great consolation writing about his illness and approaching it like the reporter that he was. It gave him some distance, I think, from what he was coping with. Mm-hmm. And in a column that I wrote about him, a tribute to the grace and courage that he had shown in fighting this really awful disease over a long period of time, I pointed out that this was a man who really couldn't handle a sinus infection very well. And so I think he was as surprised as I was that he was able to step up to this challenge.
How did you discover, Eleanor, that he had cancer? And what was his reaction to it?
Well, the original diagnosis, his symptom was he had experienced blood in the urine, and he did go to the doctor, and the doctor initially dismissed it, said that he was a runner, and he was an athlete, and he was happy to hear that. But then he also had an appointment with a urologist not long after, and it was the urologist who immediately kicked into action and ordered a series of tests. And when Tom got the phone call from Ginger, I still remember the secretary the nurse in the doctor's office, she called to say that the doctor wanted to see him about the mass on his kidney. And he said, mass? It was the first he'd heard of it. And he said, couldn't we use the word nodule instead? he didn't want to use the word mass. And they immediately did tests to make sure that the cancer had not spread even at the original diagnosis, because then that would have dictated how they would have proceeded. And it hadn't spread, so they went ahead with surgery. And Tom then joked that he didn't have cancer, his kidney did. Mm-hmm. And that was a line that he borrowed from President Reagan, who, when he was in the White House, he was operated on for colon cancer and afterwards said that he didn't have cancer, his colon did. And I remember Larry Speaks, the White House press secretary, calling in reporters who covered the White House and said, you know, please don't ridicule the president for saying this, because it's important in his recovery that he have this kind of attitude. So from the beginning, you know, Tom was able, I think, to draw on his natural wit and also his journalistic talents to both deal with the disease and investigate it. And he did both for a number of years.
I wonder, Eleanor Clift, if you would read from your book. This is chapter 14. This is the chapter where you talk about saying goodbye. In fact, that's the title of the chapter.
Yeah, the book is written in diary form, and it's really the last 2 weeks in the lives of these two very different people, Tom Brazaitis and Terry Schiavo. And chapter 14 is the date of Tom's death, and the title of the chapter is Saying Goodbye. The climactic event I have been preparing for these many months, if not years, has happened. How do I feel? Like somebody punched me in the gut. It's hard to breathe. I'm shivering, but it's not from the cold. It isn't cold. It's from the shock. I'm aware that I'm crying, but at the same time my mind is racing. I should have sat with him the night before. I didn't realize he was that close to death. In retrospect, I should have known, but it's pointless to beat myself up over what I didn't do. Tom was no longer aware of his surroundings. He was in another place within himself, and we had said our goodbyes. What had kept me sane was getting my rest and going to bed at a decent hour so that whatever I found the next morning I could deal with. To be honest, I'd come down the stairs every morning, half expecting to find him dead. Daphne calls and says she'll be right over. She pronounces Tom dead at 10:40 a.m. I tell her that I knew he was dead much earlier and ask if she can estimate the time of death. Eleanor, it doesn't matter, she says. Still, it is a weight on me that I feel a need to justify. I tell her how that morning I could see the sheet moving, and as I look down on my dead husband, I can still see the sheet moving. It is the air mattress generating the movement. Daphne asks if I want her to double-check that he has indeed passed away. No, I say, he is gone. He needed to die. She calls the funeral home.
You know, as you read that, honestly, the first thing that came to my mind is I've been listening to you for so many years, I can hear some of the emotion that's coming through your voice. I wonder how hard it was for you to write this and for you to go so public with this. In many ways, was it therapeutic? Was it painful? How did you decide to do that?
Well, the going public part was difficult for me from the beginning. And actually, Tom wanted to go public, and we had done radio shows on living with cancer. When he decided to have whole brain radiation, we talked about it publicly. And he drew solace from this. And I always kind of dreaded these interviews because I knew the questions would always be, you know, well, if you have a short amount of time left, how are you going to spend this time? And I think I was always afraid Tom would say, we're going to go on a round-the-world cruise, or we're going to, you know, move to Tibet. And instead, he would always say, no, I just want my life as normal as possible. And that was always a great relief to me. When I was offered the idea for this book. I had mentioned I had written this column about Tom and the courage he had shown, and attracted the interest of a publisher in New York. And I thought he wanted me to write a political book. And halfway through the lunch we had together, he said, you have a personal story to tell. And I said, yeah, I'll tell it in the memoir I write someday. And he said, no, you should tell it now and frame it in the context of Terry Schiavo's death and the incredible debate that we had in this country. I initially wasn't sure it could work, but as I looked at that two-week period, I could tell my personal story through flashbacks, because not a lot changed in Tom's condition those last 2 weeks. But they were an incredible back and forth, ethically, medically, scientifically, politically, around the Terry Schiavo case. And so in a way, I did the same thing Tom did. I put on my reporter's hat, and I could get some distance from the story I was writing, and I could talk to end-of-life experts and ethicists, and I did all that, and then I switched back and forth in the book from my personal story and my voice to, you know, what I do, which is reporting. And so I think it was a cathartic experience, and it helped me sort out what had happened to me and how radically my life had changed. It kept me busy for 2.5 years.
Yes. Well, as I read, this is not a political book. I mean, you seem sympathetic to all sides, to Terry Schiavo's parents, to Michael Schiavo, to, you know, while all the while pointing at your husband and reminding us that it's possible to endure death with dignity and even hope. I mean, was that the goal?
Well, I think, you know, if you want to compare these two deaths, I mean, they're very different. And I think dying at home with hospice care, with family and friends and in your own surroundings, that's the closest thing we can come to, I think, to what we would call a good death. And I think Terry Schiavo being the center of the family feud from hell over what should happen to her was certainly the opposite of what most of us would want. And so I think there are warning lessons to people if you don't have the will really to put down on paper exactly what you think you might want and not want, at least entrust somebody who knows you and knows your values, who can speak for you. And in truth, most of these situations are settled quietly around the bedside. It's very rare that it goes into the courts and then gets bounced to the U.S. Congress, and the President of the United States flies back, interrupts his vacation, signs legislation, basically urging the federal courts to overturn the state courts, which didn't happen, of course.
Right. This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson, in for Tom Ashbrook. I'm joined by journalist Eleanor Clift. Her new book is 2 Weeks of Life, a memoir of love, death, and politics. It's a poignant tribute to her husband, journalist Tom Brazidis. He entered hospice care after living with kidney cancer for more than 5 years. He was 64 years old when he died. I wonder if you would take us to those moments, Eleanor, when you took care of him for a long time. You did everything from preparing meals to administering shots and, of course, then much more toward the end of his life. I wonder if you would describe for us what that was like and at what point you realized that, you know, it's time for hospice to move in.
Well, I think one thing I learned throughout this is that the human spirit can withstand a lot. And the treatments that Tom underwent in the hope of beating his cancer and not beating it, certainly stabilizing it, had horrendous side effects. He called them the shake and bakes. You would be so cold, you would shake, and you would be so hot that you had to have ice packs on you. It would sort of mimic the worst of flu symptoms. And he would take a variety of shots, and we would get the medicines delivered to the door in an ice chest, and he would mix them, and we were quite a little pharmacy. But, you know, you get used to it. I remember we would go to a golf course, and you go off into the woods and give a shot. And at the time, we had an elderly cat who was diabetic, and Tom decided that we should go ahead and give her shots because he was getting a second chance. She should, too. So we also had the cat shots, too. So we got all of this down pretty good. And I began to think that there was always another, you know, clinical trial around the corner and that we could extend this almost indefinitely. But it was after Thanksgiving in 2004, when we were at the oncologist, and the oncologist suggested that we might want to take a break from the chemotherapy and that Tom could go home and regain his strength. he made it sound so good that Tom thought this was kind of good news and a step along the road to recovery. But I heard tucked in there the little word hospice care. And I didn't know much about hospice, but I knew that it came attached with a doctor's determination that you had 6 months or less left to live.
And as I remember, you started crying at that moment.
I started crying, and Tom later said that he had thought it was good news until he saw me crying. It was the right decision to make, and I went from knowing very little about hospice to I now serve on the board of the National Hospice and Palliative Care Organization. And they really do wonderful work because they minister not only to the patient, but also to the family, and they provide a variety of services. But initially, I didn't know a lot about it, and I thought, well, maybe somebody was going to move in and, you know, help me do this. And I realized that's not the case. We never saw a physician. You have a primary care nurse who's assigned, who stops by, you know, at the outset, maybe twice a week, and then you get health aid services as needed. But essentially, you're in charge. And I do remember one day joking with Tom that I was kind of getting to enjoy this, you know, being the caregiver, you know, lining up the medicines and organizing the day and all of that. And he said, "You better be careful. I hear they're recruiting from the ranks." So his sense of humor is something that I think preserved in this book. And I do want to say that the book is not a downer. You know, there are some very positive moments, and, you know, death is inevitable, as you said earlier. And I remember thinking as I was writing the book is, how come we're so bad at this? Because we've been dying ever since we've been on this earth. But it's a relatively new phenomenon of people living, you know, longer lives. And hospice in particular is suited to cancer because people can really live with cancer for quite some time, and then there's often a fast decline, and so it fits into the hospice timeline.
I wonder, Eleanor, if you would read again from the book the part, I believe it's page 32, where you talk about the hospice care and moving the bed into the family living room.
Okay. On Tom's hospice chart, it says, aware of diagnosis, accepting of prognosis, understands prognosis, family communicates honestly with each other. Daphne's notes quote Tom saying, "I've difficulty sometimes distinguishing between a dream, thoughts, reality, what really happened." She goes on to note, "Wife reports PT, paren patient, thought he might not be in his home as he was, and that he was in Paris. Patient says his orientation to time is the most compromised right now. Patient possesses a good sense of humor. This place is like a waiting room," Tom says, referring to our living room with newspapers and magazines strewn on the coffee table. When he sees my consternation, he says, "No problem, I haven't been here that long." It has actually been more than 2 months since that January day when he could no longer navigate the stairs from our bedroom to the living room. The hospital bed had been brought in much earlier, awaiting the day when it would be needed. For a long time, it was the elephant in the room. We treated it like another piece of furniture to pile stuff on. When the time came to make the transition, Jeff Wright, a physical therapist sent by hospice, asked Tom how he would feel about being carried down the stairs. "Not good," Tom said. So we rented a wheelchair, and with Tom strapped into the wheelchair and with the help of a football player-sized friend, Jeff turned the trip down the stairs into a joyride. Illness is beginning to rob Tom of his ability to speak, but on this day he still manages to call me Lovey. I know the word is precious. I write it down and date it, 3/18/05, which would have been 22 days before he died. Yeah.
And, you know, he was affectionate with you when he was sick in a way that he wasn't before, right?
Well, he was affectionate when he was going through some of these horrible treatments and he had these high fevers. And he would express his great love for me. And as he said, when he was in his normal state, he said he was not a man who was good at expressing affection. And so we would laugh about that, actually. So... hey, I took whatever affection I could get under whatever terms.
What was your experience, Eleanor, first with death? And what did you learn from Tom's experience? Because I remember reading in the book where you quote a psychotherapist who treats children and adults traumatized by death. And you quote her where she advises to surrender and pay attention. Even if you ultimately lose your loved one, don't lose the lesson. So I wonder, what was the lesson for you?
Well, I have three sons. They're grown, and they took turns spending time with me. And my oldest son, before he flew back to California, which is where he lives, turned to me and said, you know, enjoy it. And I looked at him with horror on my face. He said, well, I don't mean enjoy. He said, I mean experience it. Mm. This is life. And here's, you know, your child telling you this. Yeah. But it is extraordinary to be able to be with someone as they are leaving this life. And there was one hospice physician I spoke with, and she said that she estimates that she has been with some 3,000 people when they died. And she said she wasn't particularly religious, but that she says a prayer each time because of the humility that she feels and how small her powers are in the face of this momentous happening. And she also went on to say that there are very few ideologues who work with the very sick and the dying. And she related one elderly man who wanted his mistress smuggled in to say goodbye, and another gentleman who begged her to sedate him so heavily that he wouldn't spill the beans on whatever secrets he was keeping and wanted to take to the grave. Mm. So, you know, I think that death needs to be taken out of the closet, and we need to treat it as one of the major milestones in life and not pretend that it doesn't happen. And I do say in the book that Tom and I watched 6 Feet Under, the HBO series about the family that owns a funeral home. And that opened up conversations between the two of us about what was happening. And a full year before Tom died, he arranged for his cremation. He went to a funeral home and got what's called a pre-need packet, and he handed me the envelope, and I stubbornly didn't open it until I needed to, but boy, I was glad to have had it.
A relief, yeah.
Yes.
A long line of callers, Eleanor, who would like to join this conversation, so I want to invite some in here. Harold is on the line from Quincy, Massachusetts. Hi, Harold. You're on the line with Eleanor Clift. Welcome.
I can strongly identify with your story today. I'm a widower. My wife passed July of 2001. She had metastasized mm-hmm. lung cancer. I identify with the hospice at home. I believe that dignity and love are the ingredients that enabled my wife to die in her living room in the hospital bed, just as your husband. She begged me not to send her to a nursing home. Mm-hmm. I gave her her last drops of morphine, so I performed euthanasia on my wife. The hospice people were absolutely wonderful. I believe that if you can have chemotherapy and radiation and treatments to prolong life, it's a beneficial asset that we've learned about in medicine. But when the futility is a reality, the honesty of the love between people that care for each other, we're not afraid to have death come as a friend and a relief of the suffering that the living watch their loved ones. We can't be selfish to keep them. I've done this with cats because I'm a cat lover. And I allowed my father to die when he had congestive heart failure and he was in the hospital, and he begged me not to let them put him under more machinery because they couldn't revive him for any quality of life. Mm. I held his hand while he died, and I held it for 15 minutes before I told the doctors. I let him die because he asked me to. I gave my wife her last drink of morphine.
Harold, thank you so much for your call. There's a lot in there, isn't there, Eleanor?
Yes. I gave a talk at a bookstore, and at the end, somebody came through the line and said to me, "Eleanor, you make hospice sound so good, I can hardly wait." Now, that wasn't exactly the point, and I don't mean to sugarcoat it, because you see there's a lot of suffering, and frankly, you know, morphine is the drug of choice. It comes in liquid form. There are patches every which way, and there is some controversy over morphine hastening death. Now, I think what this gentleman said, that he performed euthanasia on his wife, I don't think that's that would not meet the legal definition, I don't believe. Morphine relieves pain. Cancer patients have significant pain because the cancer gets in Tom's case. It was in the bones. It was in the brain. There's significant pain. And morphine relieves pain, but it can also hasten death by maybe hours, you know. So
Harold mentioned that the hospice program, you mentioned it as well, and you say in your book those hospice nurses seemed pretty wonderful, the ones that worked with you and your husband.
They explain everything, and they do it matter-of-factly, and so you understand what's going on. And I remember the very rapid breathing towards the end. Tom and I had run marathons together, and I commented that he sounds like he's trying to cross the finish line. Mm-hmm. And then I realized as I said it, well, that's exactly what he's doing, and dying is hard work. And there's a period that they call active dying, and the nurses know when the patient enters into that phase. And food and water, which, of course, was the central focus of the Terry Schiavo case, whether food and water delivered by an artificial feeding tube is medicine or whether it's an inalienable right. But when people are in their final days and from terminal illness, they don't want food, and yet people feel like offering food is an act of love. And Tom clamped his mouth shut 3 days before he died. I couldn't have gotten any food past those teeth if I tried. Mm. And I don't know how much of that was conscious or how much is just the body reacting. But the debate over Terry Schiavo was that she wasn't dying. She could have lived for decades more if she remained on this life support. And during that period of time, I did think the courts had decided accurately that she did need to die, I did come to understand the other side, if you will, and particularly the concerns of the disability community, which felt that if Terry Schiavo's life was devalued, that it's the slippery slope, the fears of the slippery slope, that they could be next. Mm-hmm. So it wasn't quite as cut and dry with one side, believing that she should live primarily for culture of life and religious reasons, that there were valid concerns.
I have about a minute left before we have to go to break, and I wonder what Tom would have thought of your book. What would your husband have thought of what you've written?
I think he would be pleased because, as a friend said to me, he gets the last word. All the dozen columns that he wrote are all in the appendix of the book. And as I said, he was very public. He was a well-known columnist in Cleveland. As he once said to me, my face was on the side of the bus. And he had a lot of loyal readers in Cleveland, and they followed his situation. And was a fallen away Catholic who called himself an atheist at the end of his life, but he had all of these people out there praying for him. So he got a lot of comfort from that.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson, in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking with Eleanor Clift about her new book, 2 Weeks of Life, a memoir of love, death, and politics. In this book, Eleanor Clift contrasts the very private death of her husband, journalist Tom Brazidis, with the highly politicized death of Terry Schiavo. The result is a close look at what it means to deal with death, either on our own or with someone that we love. I want to talk about grieving, Eleanor, for a moment, and how you grieve. Because in your book, you describe a moment. I just want to read this because I think it's really interesting. A moment when you had to decide whether to go back on the air on the McLaughlin Group just after Tom's death. And you write this. Admittedly, it is not standard fare for the grieving widow. And a friend who calls me up to see how I'm doing counsels me against popping up on television so soon after Tom's death. It will further the impression of you as someone with ice in your veins, she says, a comment that chills me on several levels. You go on to say that grieving is individual. There are no rules. Some people sit in a darkened room with shades drawn, whereas others find solace or at least distraction in activity. My friend's remark is searing and it throws me off, but the incident reinforces my own instinct that for me, continuing my work life, my normal routine, is my salvation. So there are two points that I take from that story, and I hope you don't mind me reading it. But the first is how you grieve, and the second is what people say to you upon someone's death, and sometimes how insensitive, albeit well-meaning, these things may be.
Well, we really don't have a language for this, and people are understandably awkward. They're awkward when they approach somebody who is very sick. I do recount in the book going out to the Gridiron. Tom was very active in the Gridiron, which is a group of journalists that puts on musical roast of politicians every year. And it was the last time we were out together, and he was very shaky on his feet and quite visibly ill. And one of the guests at the dinner said very effusively, "Oh, you know, you look so great. This is great." And I kind of gave her the daggers, and I said, "He's not great." And then I felt bad. And then later in the evening, she came over and apologized, and she actually said, this was a spouse, she actually said that she was a nurse and that she knows better. And she just meant to say that it was great that he was there that evening. So occasionally, emotion would come popping out of me that I didn't intend. But Tom died on a Wednesday, and it was Easter week, and we had taped a show for the McLaughlin Group, so we weren't going to be taping that Friday. But because Terry Schiavo had just died, and Pope John Paul was sick and would die that weekend, John McLaughlin felt that we needed to do a show, and he called me up and he said, "Would you feel comfortable doing the show?" And I leapt at the chance because here I was. I had, I don't know, 20 floral bouquets, two giant deli platters. And I could have, you know, serviced a stream of mourners for days, but that isn't how it worked. I didn't quite know what to do. And I was really glad for the opportunity to get out of the house and to distract myself. And the way I've dealt with grief is through work. And that's what kept me going while Tom was sick. You know, I continued to write my columns. And when you're staring at that computer screen and you have to, you know, think about George W. Bush or Iraq or whatever is happening, then you're not thinking about what's happening in your living room. And, you know, you can't think about it all the time. You do need some relief. And even though the book project I eventually got involved in, you know, had me relive the last months and years, that proved cathartic because, again, if you work with words, you almost don't know what you think until you begin to put the words together. And they always say, write what you know, and I sure knew this. And
you
so
sure
I
did.
Think it was helpful for me to write it.
Let's go to the phones now. Ellen is calling from New Hampshire. Ellen, welcome to the program.
Hi, Jane.
Hi. I'm glad that you called. You're on the air. Go ahead.
And I just wanted to talk about the grieving process, as it's called. My husband had an operation for a brain tumor, a benign brain tumor, and something went wrong in the oxygen supply, and he was left in a vegetative state. And this went on for a number of years. He was very healthy. He didn't require life support. And I found it hard to distance myself emotionally for quite a long time. But time sort of takes care of things, but it takes a long time. a long time, and I'm thinking now of Faulkner. I think it was Faulkner who said, "The past is never past."
Mm-hmm.
And now thinking about it and talking about it brings back some of the bad feelings.
How difficult it must have been. I'm so sorry for you, Ellen, and I really appreciate your call. And Eleanor, would you like to respond?
Yeah. There aren't a lot of guidebooks for grieving, and again, it is individual, and I sometimes think, you know, closure is the most overworked word in the English language.
Mm-hmm.
I did attend some bereavement groups at the Washington Home, which was the hospice that oversaw Tom's care, and it was all women, and there was one man, and the one man was talked about how he was writing a book about how he could love two women at once, his wife who had recently died or was dying, and the new woman that he was with. And as I looked around this circle of grieving widows, I think we were all about ready to chase him out of the room. That was rather unusual. But I think, you know, it's women who will go out and try to find some comfort in the experiences of others. And, you know, let's face it, there are more widows than there are widowers.
Another call now from Jeff, who is in Santee, South Carolina. Jeff, welcome to the program.
Hello, Jane. Thanks Hi. For having me. And, Eleanor, I'm enjoying your story very much.
Thank you.
I was diagnosed with kidney cancer in last November and subsequently had the kidney removed. That's, from what I've understood, that's the primary treatment. There's not a lot of other good options.
Right.
And I'm hoping that I don't end up, you know, going down the same medical path as your husband. It's a waiting game now on metastasis. But
right.
I have to say, when they first started your story, it scared me to death because of my recent experience. And I was a runner, and it so very much paralleled my experience. But as
right.
I've listened, I've gotten a little more comfort
right.
in how you were able to handle it.
Well, the statistics are on your side. I think it's something like 80% who have the kidney removed don't have another symptom. And frankly, we thought we would be in that category too, but it was at the one-year checkup that the metastases were revealed.
And what would you say to Jeff, Eleanor, about his experience and what he might go through?
Well, I would say that he just needs to be vigilant, and that, again, the statistics are on his side. And Tom, I in his columns, talks a lot about the statistics because he kept falling in the bad side. But he even found solace there because he was relatively young and healthy, and he always thought that he had a chance to beat this illness, and he was going to give it all he had. And then if it wasn't going to work, he was going to live out the days that he had as best as he could. Mm-hmm. Kidney cancer, even if it does metastasize, is slow growing. Again, Tom lived almost 5 years with metastatic cancer, which is a good long while. Mm-hmm. So there are some positive things to look at, even if you get the worst diagnosis.
Another call now from Concord, Massachusetts. Nancy is on the line. Nancy, welcome.
Hi. Thanks so much for having me. And Eleanor, I'm anxious to read your book. I haven't read it yet, but I'm looking forward to it. I'm 44, but 3 years ago, actually on May 22nd, I entered the hospital and was suffering from liver failure, unbeknownst to me, and had an emergent liver transplant 1 week after arriving. Mm-hmm. And I was separated from my husband at the time. And to your point about preparing yourself or your family or making some of these arrangements is so important. And I obviously didn't think it was. At 41, I was healthy. I had never, you know, had any kind of serious illness ever. But because I was separated, I thought I was fortunately conscious when I entered the hospital, and I was able to make the decision to name my parents as healthcare proxies.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, there were many things, fortunately, that were lined up for me in terms of I did have a great medical insurance with Blue Cross Blue Shield, who I honestly cannot say enough good about, and I know that's unusual in today's day and age, but they were phenomenal, and fortunately my now ex-husband, estranged husband at the time, had just changed over to that plan. Mm. And I would had excellent medical care, but I fell into a coma 3 days after I was taken to Beth Israel from Emerson Hospital in Concord. And had I not made that decision, you know, I would love to think that things would have turned out okay. But, you know, I wonder, you know, if I might not be the next Terry Schiavo.
Right. It's a very good point, Nancy. I really appreciate your call. The issue of living wills, Eleanor, critical, I guess.
Yes, and also the durable power of attorney, that yes. somebody can speak for you if you can't speak for yourself. And I think that is really the most important, because even the living wills, you can't. It's very difficult to predict every medical situation that you might fall into. I mean, as this caller put it, she certainly didn't expect to fall into a coma and have liver failure in her, you know, early 40s. And most of us, I mean, I'm glad we don't go through life with a cloud over our head thinking this might happen, that might happen. And so the simplest thing is to name the healthcare proxies as this woman did.
I want to get another call in here from Austin, Texas. Will is on the line. Will, welcome.
Hi, Jane. How are you?
Hi. Thank you for calling. Go ahead.
I was diagnosed about 4 years ago with prostate cancer, and I'm doing fine now, but prostate cancer is incurable, basically. So I know eventually I'm going to get to the point where I need to go to hospice and you know, die the way I want to die. But I'm just curious as to how your guests would work, get the family, my family, my wife in particular, and my family to accept the fact that eventually I'm going to die of prostate cancer and we need to do hospice. It's hard for me to broach that subject with my wife. Although she's been wonderful, but it's hard for me to broach that subject with her.
Thank you, Will.
Well, prostate cancer is one of the most curable cancers, so I don't know what your particular situation is, you know, I would think that if you have been, you know, diagnosed with a terminal condition, then again, a physician is going to estimate what your remaining life might be.
But and the advice to a family that may not want to hear that it's
well,
time.
Yes, but that's where the medical professionals have to be a little bold too, and not just tell families what they want to hear. Mm-hmm. You know, it's we all want to believe our loved ones are indestructible, but when a serious illness takes hold, you can see that wear away on someone, and you can see the suffering. And so you don't necessarily want to prolong, needless suffering in a life that is more of a, you know, a burden and a hardship to the person living it. Mm.
Another call now from Hudson, Massachusetts. Deborah is on the line. Deborah, welcome to On Point.
Thank you, Jane, and great show as usual. I just wanted to laud those professionals known as the hospice team. I recently lost my dad. Even though he was 88, it was an unexpected blood clot, which led to gangrene in his leg, which turns out is one of the most painful ways to go. And none of us five children, we could not imagine the actual moment of death. And the hospice team, which was present in the nursing home, really held us in their arms along with him and brought us through every single moment together with him. And our fears that he would be in pain or that he would be alone were so taken care of by them. This was 2 months ago, and not a day goes by where I bless them and where I don't bless them and thank them for all of their care.
Well, thank you for that's a wonderful call, Deborah. I really appreciate that.
Right. It's rare that that a family that has experience with hospice care doesn't come away, you know, feeling that this, as people put it, it's the best kind of medical care that nobody wants, because again, it does signal that you've reached the end of the road, or as Tom put it, the end game.
Eleanor, we have to wrap up here. I wonder, what is the one thing you would say to Americans from your own experience? In this wonderful book, what would you say to Americans about the experience of dying and what we should be talking about as it relates to death in this country?
Well, I think we need to look at death with the same honesty and the same humor, if you will, that we do at the other momentous passages of life. And the more you're able to talk about it, and people, as some of these calls indicate, people want to talk about this stuff. They
right.
really do.
Right.
And it takes away the mystery, and if you take away some of the mystery, it takes away the fear. And I think that's why we just need to have more open conversations, both within families and probably among our policymakers as well.
Well, thank you for the conversation that you have started with this book, which again is just really wonderful. Thank you. 2 Weeks of Life, A Memoir of Love, Death, and Politics. Eleanor Clift, I appreciate your time today.
Thank you, Jane.
Listeners, you can continue the conversation and download the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. Great to be with you this week. I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook, who will be back on Monday. Our program is produced by Julie Jopp, Eileen Amata, Stefano Katsonis, Hillary McQuilkin, Chelsea Merce, Tanya Raleigh, James Ross, Karen Schiffman, and John Wibby. Our senior producer is Wen Stevenson. Have a great weekend. This is On Point.